WEIF, New York.
Good morning. At this time, we take you to the far corners of the globe for a roundup of news reports. We're to hear from our on-the-scene reporters in the Southwest Pacific, in London, and our own nation's capital in Washington. First, we take you to the Far East. Go ahead, Sydney, Australia.
This is Mervyn K. Schlossberg speaking from Sydney, Australia, 11 p.m. Friday. It is revealed that in yesterday's raids on Darwin, 15 persons were killed and 24 wounded. 9 of these were postal employees. These people kept at their posts throughout the raid and are the first war casualties among civilians on Australia's mainland. There was an alert today, but no raid. It will be remembered that alerts were sounded in December and January over Darwin, and that resulted in raids. On this occasion, all expect that there will be further raids. Parliament met in secret session today to consider the government's policies and plans for the conduct of the war. This session was placed into national security regulations regarding secrecy in such a meeting. This is a new feature and indicative of the importance of the steps to be taken. The government today gazetted regulations by which power is given to government officers duly authorized to give verbal orders to citizens and others as necessary. This is in case there is no time for other orders. The regulations affect equally persons and property and are the most drastic ever issued in this country. They direct the citizen to perform specified services as directed, perform specified duties in his own trade or business as directed, and to place his property under the direction of the government. These regulations place every person in Australia under the orders of the government and remove voluntary cooperation in an emergency or in the lack of time. This drastic order is a sequel to the promulgation of the economic controls that I've already mentioned. Both are real total mobilization, what have been talked about as possible but never seriously broached. I point out again that all this is being done by a Labour government, which is opposed on principle to compulsion, but is forced by circumstances to resort to it. However, as Mr. Curtin said the other day, and as opposition speakers have said as well, the chapter of controversy is over in Australia. One tremendous effect of this war and all the changes in political and economic matters that it involves in Australia is that on the states. As in the United States, this country is a federation in which the federal and state governments have definitely marked out powers. However, the war has brought about a number of questions upon which there can be only one decision made. For example, in air raid precautions, in rounding up enemy aliens, and utilization of transport, to mention just a few, the states have cooperated with the federal authorities, though acting within their own spheres. In a matter of ARP work, the states have practically been delegated as agents of the federal government. From the police, the military have received assistance in their problems, and the federal authorities have asked for and received the services of important state public service in the carrying out of the program. One paper suggests that if the states do not cooperate, the government at Canberra will act first as it sees fit and argue later. But so far, cooperation, especially in the case of New South Wales and Queensland, have been all that one would expect. The listing of numerous industries and trades as non-essential, prohibited, will greatly cut down the list of reserved occupations. Those in these occupations will either enter the armed forces or take up munitions or other war work. At the time of Darwin was being bombed yesterday morning, the city of Sydney and other coastal areas in New South Wales had its first daylight raid test. Generally speaking, it was successful, and the streets were emptied in record time. Remember that between 1.5 million and 2 million people live in the area tested yesterday. In an interview today, Mr. J.T. Lang, former Premier of New South Wales, one of the leading figures in Australian Labour, said that now the war is one for Australia herself, with her own city threatened. He said that Australians must meet the threat with the same fighting spirit shown by Australians in distant theatres of the war. And this time, Australia is far from, and a long wait time, from England or America. The country is on its own, and the decisions of the government now taken must be taken from courage, not from fear, if good decisions are to be made. The press, too, emphasizes that this is Australia's great test. There must be, says one paper, full unity and obedience, and it goes on to say that though raids are not invasions, we must expect them, too. The raids on Darwin will hasten raid precaution activity. Trenches are being dug in schools and parks to a greater extent than was thought necessary a week ago. First aid posts have been set up in all vulnerable areas, manned by trained workers. I now return you to San Francisco.
And now from San Francisco across the continent to our newsroom in New York.
Now, here in New York, we have news from Batavia. Allied warships and submarines last night attacked Japanese invasion forces concentrated in the waters around the island of Bali, separated from Java's eastern tip by only a mile-wide strait. This, as announced by the Dutch East Indies High Command today. And the official communique didn't say whether any enemy forces had effected a landing on the island, only adding that further particulars are lacking as no complete report has yet been received. Earlier reports said the Dutch were resisting strenuously. Now for another overseas broadcast, this one from London, England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. London military quarters today say fierce fighting is in progress on both sides of the Belen River in Burma. There have been successful attacks and counterattacks, and both British and Japanese losses have been heavy. Messages from the spot are delayed, but when last reports reached here, the British positions were still intact. It's stated in London that Rangoon hasn't been abandoned, but material for China is now being routed through India. No confirmation has yet arrived here of the reported Japanese landing on the island of Timor. Announcement of the War Cabinet changes came too late last night for the ordinary British evening news broadcasts. When the British public this morning heard of the new War Cabinet, the general comment was favorable. People were pleased that Mr. Churchill had interpreted public opinion and realized that the demand for a more efficient conduct of the war was a real one. Only one new man comes into the War Cabinet, Sir Stafford Cripps. But his popularity with the public, based on the fact that he was ambassador to Moscow when Britain and Russia became allies, makes him one of the country's outstanding figures. People recall that he was pro-Russian when many British leaders were anti-Russian. As leader of the House of Commons, he'll take much of the parliamentary burden off Mr. Churchill's shoulders. Mr. Churchill has himself admitted that the fact that he's had to spend much of his time in the House of Commons has increased his work. Cripps is a powerful speaker and should have little difficulty in handling the House. He's not associated with any party. Before he went to Russia, he was expelled by the official Labour Party because of what were thought to be too unorthodox views. Sir Stafford didn't take to party discipline. American sources who know Sir Stafford's political views say that if you're an American, he'd be a sort of middle-of-the-road New Deal figure. Three men have left the War Cabinet. First, Lord Beaverbrook, who a few days ago lost what seems to have been an undercover tug-of-war with Labour Minister Bevan for control of British manpower. Lord Beaverbrook may have felt that he couldn't carry out his job of bossing production without bossing manpower, too. On the other hand, he knows the American industrial scene better than most Britishers and may be valuable in helping pool the resources of the Allied nations. Sir Kingsley Wood, long a Conservative Party machine boss, is also out of the War Cabinet. He was often referred to as one of the Munich influences in the government, and critics have usually picked him as one of the members the War Cabinet could best spare. Mr. Arthur Greenwood, the third member who leaves the War Cabinet, was brought into it originally as one of the Labour Party representatives. Original choice of him, like Sir Kingsley Wood, was generally taken as a political move, a tribute to his party position rather than any inherent personal ability. Oliver Littleton, War Cabinet representative in the Middle East, is on his way back to take over production. Mr. Littleton is 48. He's a conservative businessman who only entered the political arena a couple of years ago. As president of the Board of Trade, he did what is generally admitted to have been an efficient job, and observers of all parties have a great deal of respect for his ability. More governmental changes are expected next week. Most important will probably be the replacement of Mr. Amory, now Secretary of State for India. He's been strongly criticized for what has been described as Britain's do-nothing India policy. His going will probably be the signal for a quick about-face in British policy toward India. India is facing attack, and the fall of Singapore proved that Britain's traditional colonial policy isn't good enough to stand the test of fire. A few days ago, the London Times printed a powerful article from its correspondent who escaped from Singapore to Batavia. The article analyzed the failure of the Malaya defense, and in doing so, indicted the failure of British colonial administrators to achieve any real link with the peoples they governed. The Times analysis has made a big impression here, and it's being predicted that Lord Moyne, the colonial secretary, will be replaced as token of a new line in British colonial policy. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Next to our own capital, for the report of our good friend Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
Well, good morning, folks. Anybody certainly ought to be genial with that nice introduction. I think that Washington, and possibly the Washington's going to lead the country this time, getting around to the idea that that we ought to talk more about offense and think less and talk less about defense. You know, in the main job of landing on the Jerrys and the Japs, we are and will be on the offensive, which is the up-and-doing manner in which Americans have fought from the very first. It seems plain when you recall that the president, in his first and really great address to Congress, asking for war and planes and more planes, the skies filled with planes, he said we would beat the Axis on their own home grounds. Then along comes the matter-of-fact Henry Stimson yesterday, Secretary of War, with the same idea, brought a little bit more down to date, and in a little bit more detail and a little bit of advice about defense. Said this nation is piling up its strength for the earliest possible offensive, and for that reason will probably suffer a few raids, forays, kicks in the shin, rather than bite off a little Army and Navy force here and another there and another somewhere else, by trying to keep up with the enemy raids and possible shellings and bombings and forays and concentrate on defense alone, it would be possible to be on the defense all the time. And so the up-and-doing American people, used to getting in the big punch first, seem to me to have their wish. We are promised that our plan is to attack and attack and attack. And Major General Carl Spatz, head of the Army's Air Combat Force, delivered a fighting message to his folks yesterday saying that the Army Air Corps mission, now listen to this, is to win absolute aerial supremacy on all fronts. Then, said the general, we will wage devastating warfare against the Axis. However, three influential senators want defense for their own folks, Walsh of Massachusetts, Byrd of Virginia, Johnson of California, urge additional home protection in the face of Secretary of War Stimson's warning. Walsh believes coast defenses should be strengthened. Johnson of California, he's right facing the Pacific, he thinks following Stimson's advice, we should do something to protect ourselves. Byrd says the American people ought to be protected to whatever extent is necessary. And, of course, Henry Stimson didn't exactly say he was going to throw us to the wolves. Well, there are great doings in our town. The Senate not only threw itself into complete reverse on the less than month-old retirement plan for Congress, Cabinet, and the President, but it also concluded that the old folks at age 60 will get no $30 a month under the Downey of California ham and eggs program. Some folks may say that the Senate is saying, if we don't get it, nobody gets it. At any rate, the Senate got itself into a jam that only a jiu-jitsu operator could undo, because it found itself confronted first with the necessary routine pay bill for the Army and Navy, to which Senator Byrd of Virginia hooked on his trailer in the nature of that repeal of the pensions for Congress and Cabinet and President, the two having nothing in common. Atop of this combine, Senator Downey of California finally forced a vote on his ham and eggs $30 at age 60 plan, and the Senate threw that down 49-22. The Senate, the House, decides that there have been enough plans and turned down an elaborate bill providing a great setup of plans for public works and whatnot after the war. It was a bill carrying out the administration's idea of how to get men to work on a vast pool of public works after the war, when there will be possible large unemployment. But the House, after the scheme had been laughed down as a boondoggling venture, voted it down 249-104, and that's all from Washington at this time.
And there you have the latest news, both at home and abroad. Reporters heard on this program were John McVane from London, Mervyn Schlossberg from Sydney, Australia, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.